There is no way to escape the reality of patterns. It's how our world works. A pattern is any combination of qualities or factors that operate with consistency. If you look around right now, you will see things created by patterns. You may see a chair, a window, or even this book you're reading. When I look around, I see those things too, but when I look more deeply, I also see patterns. Functional chairs, windows, and books are all produced based on patterns that have proven effective. A similar dynamic applies to our inner patterns, which are simply our habits of thought and behavior. If we are serious about becoming whole, we must be aware of and begin to see our life in terms of patterns. The fruit of everything we create is the byproduct of patterns operating beneath the surface of our lives. Because we are creatures of habit, we are predictable even more than we realize. Corporations have figured this out and spend millions of dollars studying our patterns to determine our predictabilities. Numerous consulting firms have been started because technology makes it easier to recognize and identify what people do, when they do it, and why. The thought is that if they can discover our patterns, they can create the specific outcomes they desire, which typically include making a sale of some kind. If major corporations understand the significance of our patterns and spend so much money to identify them, surely we can prioritize knowing and regulating our patterns as we work toward the goal of becoming whole and attaining the lives we desire. The framework of patterns. Our patterns are composed of three things: our perceptions, our processing, and our reactions. These three dynamics operate in a cycle that produces the fruit or outcome of a pattern. Let's take a closer look at each one. Number one, perceptions. Our perceptions are what and how we see, and they are shaped by our experiences, our worldview, and our self-view. Our inner mirror plays a big part in our perceptions because it reflects our life back to us, more or less accurately, depending on how cracked it is. To illustrate, consider the experiences of two friends, Kayla and Chad, who walk into a crowded social gathering where they know no one. Kayla notices all the beautiful clothes people are wearing and immediately feels intimidated. Chad notices the same beautiful clothes, but instead of being intimidated, he feels like these are people he'd like to meet and get to know better. It's the same situation for both Kayla and Chad, but their perceptions are very different. Number two, processing. Our processing is the inner mechanism that takes what we perceive and translates it into a storyline. The storyline communicates what the perception means to us or says about us. When Kayla processes her perceptions of the well-dressed people at the party, she develops a storyline that reinforces her perceptions. Everyone here is better off than I am. I don't belong here, and I'm pretty sure they don't want me here either. Chad's processing also leads to a storyline that reinforces his perceptions. Everyone here looks so interesting. I can't wait to meet them and see what we have in common. Number three, reactions. Our reactions are the actions we take in response to how we feel about what we perceive. Back at the party, Kayla's reaction to what she's perceived and processed is to declare that the party is boring, the people are stuck up, and she wants to go home. Chad, on the other hand, is just getting started. He's shaking hands, making friends, and can't figure out why Kayla is being such a wet blanket. This is a great party. This is the framework of a pattern. As with Kayla and Chad, a pattern is always made up of how we perceive, process, and react. If you can understand and master this sequence of events and be intentional about doing the work necessary to ensure that your patterns are healthy, your life will thrive. And there is even more good news. You don't have to work on your patterns by yourself. The God of wholeness is on your side and will guide the way. Knowing yourself. I marvel at how readily available information is today. What would have taken hours or even days of library research when I was a kid is now retrieved in a matter of seconds with a few keystrokes on a laptop or touches on a smartphone. We have access to information about everything you can imagine, from ancient history to astrophysics. We are perhaps the most knowledgeable generation of all time, except when it comes to the most important thing we could ever know, ourselves. As much of a blessing as the information age has been, its downside is its power to distract us from truly knowing ourselves. We have become so reliant on the internet and social media that we hardly get to be social and acquainted with our own selves. We are well informed about the world around us, but blinded to the happenings of the world within us. The busyness of technology often robs us of the stillness needed to really know ourselves. Our focus shifts so fast, at the speed of a click, that our minds can hardly be still. Although we are feeling things all the time, if we never stop to be still, we can never identify and examine those feelings and what may be underneath. There is a whole world happening inside of us that we don't see, which gives us no say in the outcomes that our inner world produces. Instead of making life happen, we allow life to happen to us through unseen patterns. We need to understand these patterns and master them. Trusting the process of self-knowledge. Whole people identify and manage their patterns by taking a regular inventory of their perceptions, processing, and reactions. This requires making a habit of solitude, stillness, self-examination, and soul-searching. The challenge is that too many of us don't know how to be alone and are afraid of what we may see if we spend any amount of time looking within. We've learned how to function in our dysfunction, and although we may not be operating at our full potential, at least we know that our present life is manageable. The thought of what we might find if we start dismantling the structure our life is standing on is frightening. We wonder, who might I become if I start digging around in the dark basement of my soul? What if I awaken a version of me I'm not equipped to deal with? Maybe things could be better by looking within, but what if it only makes my life worse? Maybe I should just take comfort in knowing that no one is perfect and just manage what's in front of me. These are some of the all too common fears that keep us repeating the unhealthy patterns that limit our lives. But right on the other side of those fears is the life most of us only dream of having. The starting point for spending time in quiet and self-reflection is the knowledge that you aren't really alone. As you look within, you do so in the loving presence of the God of wholeness, and there is no safer place you could be. When you are surrounded by pure love, you can look within yourself without fear or shame. Listen for the voice that says, "I've got you covered. I know you, and I'm with you. Trust me to walk you through this process. I'll take you step by step, and you will emerge victorious, new, and whole. I'm going to show you your life through my eyes, so you can see who you are destined to be. When I look at you, I see much worth and great value. All you may see right now is impenetrable rock, but I see fine and rare gold. I just need you to be courageous and to trust me as we take this journey together. The God of wholeness is invested in your becoming whole and has all of the resources in the universe and beyond at his disposal on your behalf. If you are willing to journey with him to discover your patterns, there is zero possibility of failure. Becoming traceable. Breaking unhealthy patterns is about awareness and change. If you are going to establish and maintain healthy patterns in your life, you must learn to become what I call traceable. Being traceable means you have a system that allows you to trace or track the way you perceive, process, and react in any given situation. It is to be intentional about truly knowing yourself, including what you do and why you do it. Becoming traceable means you understand your predictabilities and, when necessary, take action to change them. My process of making myself traceable is through always taking inventory of where I am and constantly asking myself a series of questions. How are you? How do you feel? Really? Are you confident or are you feeling insecure? What thoughts are shaping your state of being? How long have you felt this way? You just reacted in an unusual way. What was that about? Really? We often hear the phrase, keeping it real, in connection with how we relate to others. But we often fail to keep it real in how we relate to ourselves. The path to wholeness requires having a healthy relationship with yourself, a willingness to dig deep, and a commitment to constant self-reflection and self-examination. I'd like to let you in on an unhealthy pattern I discovered in my own life and what I did to turn my negative predictability into a positive one that enhanced my ability to maintain meaningful relationships with great people. But before I do, I want to give you a little bit of background. I've always been a people person, and relationships mean a lot to me. But I've also experienced considerable loss and unpredictability in my relational world. Many people have come and gone in my life. First, there was the move from Northern California to Southern California when I was a boy. Then I switched schools several times as my neighborhood changed or my family's upward mobility allowed me to attend better schools. When I went to college, I left some relationships behind and established new ones. Then there was my 11-year career in the corporate world, in which people and relationships were changing all the time. Perhaps the most dramatic change in my relationships happened when I left the business world to become a full-time minister. As beautiful as many of its expressions are, the Christian community does come with its occasional, shall I say, character. I'm sure I myself have been a character a time or two on my journey to wholeness. Let's just sum it all up by saying I had very few relationships that lasted beyond the time I spent in the neighborhood, the school environment, the workplace, or the church I was a part of at the time. My relationship with peers were also sometimes complicated by envious slights I often experienced. I had a unique aptitude for achievement and success, an outgoing personality, and, I humbly submit for your consideration, good looks. Beneath all these realities, I also had a difficult relationship with my father, one in which I experienced profound rejection. Given all this, you might be able to understand why relationships were a complex and often sensitive issue for me. So that's the background. Now let's get to the unhealthy pattern. In my early 30s, I begin to notice a pattern that involved my relationships with people I looked up to or admired in some way. Even though I had access to them, I was hesitant to reach out. When I did work up the nerve to contact someone, there would often be a delay in his or her response or no response at all. I would tell myself it wasn't a big deal and try to shake it off, but deep within, my attitude toward that person would change. I began to develop a negative perception and rejected that person as someone I wanted to be close to. This pattern also played itself out on social media. I would follow people I looked up to, and if I didn't get a return follow in a reasonable amount of time, I would unfollow them. I did this for years, not recognizing that it was an unhealthy pattern that had nothing to do with the other person and everything to do with me. I'm going to tell you how I trace this pattern, but before I do, I want to look at the fruit or outcome of it. There's a popular term in culture today, a hater. And that was the fruit of my unhealthy pattern. I was becoming a hater. A hater is someone who, well, hates. They don't like to see anyone but themselves succeed. They are fueled by pride, are extremely critical, and have only negative things to say about others. Some haters can be mean-spirited and cantankerous, and others just generally critical. But what I have learned after sipping my own cup of haterade a time or two is that most haters are simply people who've been hurt, usually because of an unhealthy pattern that needs to be healed. The unhealthy pattern in my life, rejecting people who didn't respond to me the way I hoped, had at times made me a hater, and I didn't like the feeling. It wasn't me at my best, and I knew it. Had this pattern persisted, it would have blocked blessings in my life and ruined relationships that were a part of my destiny. Developing the practice of tracing my patterns has become an irreplaceable discipline in my pursuit of wholeness, and the fruit has been tremendous. My relationships have become more authentic and rewarding as a result, and my more positive outlook has prospered all my endeavors in remarkable ways. I'm excited to see the same happen for you. So let's look deeper into mastering our patterns. Autopsy the fruit to trace the pattern. An unhealthy pattern always produces what I like to call dead fruit. Dead fruit is what is produced in a person's life as the result of an unhealthy pattern. The outcome is undesirable, unhealthy, and unbecoming. Dead fruit is always unpleasant, causes pain, and contaminates the soul. However, there is one redemptive benefit to dead fruit. If we are willing to take a closer look, it will reveal the source and cause of our unhealthy patterns. And by taking a closer look, I don't mean a quick glance. I mean a deep exploration intent on identifying the cause of death, which is precisely what an autopsy is. This autopsy requires two parties, you as the coroner and the God of wholeness as the chief medical examiner, who will assist you. If you're going to be healed from your unhealthy pattern, you must allow wholeness to help you do this exploratory work. He has the expertise you'll need to solve the case. For me, a big part of the unhealthy pattern that caused me to be a hater was pride. It was pride that led me to be critical of others I felt had rejected me. And it was self-protection, motivated by pride, that led me to bluff that I really didn't care about those people anyway. Pride is almost always a sign of unacknowledged or unprocessed hurt. When I recognized the pride, I knew I needed to ask more questions and dig deeper. What feeling is my pride truly masking? The answer came almost immediately. Hurt. The next question I needed to ask was, why do I feel hurt? This was hard because pride was still trying to protect me by keeping me from actually admitting the hurt. But I also knew that pride couldn't help me at all in this process. If I wanted to identify the cause of death and trace my unhealthy pattern back to its source, I had to be vulnerable and honest. What hurt me was the rejection I felt when people I respected and admired failed to respond when I reached out. This admission alone was a big step for me, and I could do it only because I felt safe and secure in the loving presence of the God of wholeness. As hard as it is to do, a vulnerable admission is always a significant step. It is the sign that you are headed down the beautiful road to freedom, healing, and the release of a debilitating pattern. Now that I admitted that I felt rejection, I had to figure out where that perception came from. Why do I feel rejected? Before I continue tracing the pattern, it's important to acknowledge a valuable truth about rejection, which is this. There is a difference between someone rejecting you and your being a reject. You are never a reject. Never. In the eyes of God, you are only ever one thing, the beloved. I like that term, beloved. It not only describes who you and I are, but it also gives us permission to be loved. It's an invitation to accept the rich and unconditional love God has for us. So hear me on this. There is never a moment when you are anything but loved, accepted, rooted for, validated, and celebrated. It is possible that people may reject you from time to time, but always know that even when they do, you are never a reject. Your identity is and always will be the beloved. If someone rejects you, it simply means that they can't see you for who you are, usually because they don't yet know who they are. This truth about rejection is one I have been especially concerned to pass on to my 15-year-old son, Isaiah. Isaiah is a budding actor, and before every audition, I coach him by telling him something like this. Now, son, you know that you don't need anything from the people in that room that you don't already have. You are loved, accepted, provided for, protected, and destined for great things. You have all this before going into that room. You are there to give something, not to get. You are already full. So just go in there confident in these things and let your light shine. Everything else will take care of itself. After the audition, and regardless of how he feels about it, I stand up, give him a high five, and tell him how proud I am of him. Then we head to the dessert venue of his choice to celebrate him, not the outcome of the audition. What I didn't realize when I first started coaching my son this way was that I was modeling wholeness to him. Okay, back to tracing my pattern. Why do I feel rejected? I realized that the rejection I felt was the narrative produced from my perceptions and my processing. Remember, the framework of a pattern involves a cycle of perceptions, processing, and reactions. When I didn't get the response I hoped for from the people I admired, I perceived rejection and therefore processed it into a narrative of rejection. My reaction was then to reject the people I perceived to have rejected me. Obviously, my reaction was problematic for a number of reasons, but let's take a closer look at my processing. Anytime an individual failed to respond to my communication, my processor automatically assumed that there could be only one explanation: willful disregard and rejection. The truth is that there could have been an unlimited number of other explanations, anything from technology glitches, hectic calendars, or personal priorities, to the need for time to gather information to make a response more helpful, and the list could go on. The more I thought about it, the more likely it seemed that these people weren't rejecting me when they didn't respond. If that was the case, then why did my processor default to concluding rejection? Because my processing was connected to my perceptions. As I mentioned in Chapter 5, our perceptions determine how we see life, ourselves, and others. My inner mirror had been cracked because of the sense of rejection I experienced in my relationship with my father. And then it was repeatedly cracked again over time when so many of my relationships were lost or fell apart. All these cracks distorted not only what I perceived in others, but also how I processed my perceptions. It meant I could never look at potential relationships clearly. I always assumed my relationships would not work out because rejection and loss were inevitable. Because I felt rejectable, I could perceive others only as potential rejectors, so I automatically labeled them untrustworthy. This negative outlook was the origin of my unhealthy pattern. After years of being robbed by it, I had finally traced and arrested the pattern by autopsying the dead fruit. Once I had uncovered the pattern's mechanics, there was only one thing left to do: change it. Breaking unhealthy patterns. Love, not condemnation or shame, is the source and the starting point for for breaking unhealthy patterns. Knowing that I was the beloved enabled me to love myself and it motivated me to know myself more intimately. I was determined to figure out how I was operating in self-defeating ways so I could make the changes that would enable me to live my one and only life to the fullest. I was fully committed to my wholeness. By tracing my unhealthy pattern to its source, I was able to put together a strategy to overcome it. It was a strategy that began with the discipline of listening to my heart. This meant routinely setting aside time to be still so I could be in touch with what I was feeling. In times past, I allowed the busyness of my life to drown out my feelings. Now I had decided that this way of living was no longer tolerable. When I attended to my heart and listened to what it had to say, I started receiving honest feedback. When my heart felt sick, I invited wholeness in to heal it. When my heart noticed the hater within arising, I went on a diligent search for the faulty processing that was creating that reaction. And the more I listened to my heart, the stronger this new pattern became. Instead of requiring a lot of effort, tracing my unhealthy patterns back to their source simply became a routine part of my operating system. Once I could identify the negative perceptions and processing, all I had to do was renounce that narrative and replace it with the highest thought about anyone I perceived had wronged me. Perhaps the most important thing I needed to regularly work on to strengthen this new and healthy pattern was my perceptions. Especially in the beginning, I needed to pay close attention to ensure that I was viewing myself from the perspective of wholeness, not brokenness. I knew that my sense of personal identity would always be the starting point for my patterns. If my self-perception was healthy, I was much more likely to enjoy healthy patterns and the rewards that follow. If my self-perception was unhealthy, unhealthy patterns would continue to form and need to be addressed. Recognizing that I couldn't always trust my perceptions, I decided to let wholeness coach me on how to see myself, how to see others, and what to expect out of this life. Wholeness's commentary on all these things was always positive and true. Wholeness affirmed my value by calling me royalty. Wholeness taught me that others are royalty too, but often don't know it. Wholeness instructed me to believe the best in others, and if I did, he would often bring out the best in them. When people disappointed me, wholeness told me to forgive them quickly, multiple times if necessary, and not to believe the lie that they would never change. Wholeness made plain to me that this didn't mean I should forgo wisdom and caution. It only meant that I should keep an open mind about them, because with wholeness, anything is possible. Wholeness also taught me that the healthiest way to perceive life is to expect good out of it. That didn't mean there wouldn't be tests and trials in life, because these are guaranteed. It just meant that I could be optimistic, joyful, and courageous in spite of them, because wholeness had already gone ahead of me, overcoming every obstacle I would face. As long as I allowed wholeness to keep my perceptions healthy, my processing improved, and I began to notice healthier reactions and better results in my relationships. It was truly life-changing. I had learned a new pattern, and this time the fruit was sweet. My old patterns didn't change overnight. I had to work at it, but they did change. And the same is possible for you. You'll have to work the new pattern until it replaces the old. And even when the new pattern becomes more established, you still can't let down your guard. We call them patterns for a reason. They like to keep coming back. Tracing patterns is a lifelong process, but it produces lifelong rewards. On the other side of why. In our efforts to produce self-awareness and reveal unhealthy patterns, perhaps the most powerful question we can ask is, why? This question shines light on all the things we just do without thinking. Asking myself why I felt hurt when I didn't hear back from people is what led to a significant breakthrough. Asking why again helped me to continue tracing my pattern back to its source. Asking why enabled me to see my underlying motivation. What really mattered wasn't so much what I was doing, my reactions, but why I was doing it, my perceptions and processing. Knowing my patterns meant asking the question why about everything I did to discover the truth about why I did it. Inevitably, my motivation revealed the source of the problem. 1 year for my birthday, I bought myself an expensive watch. Without question, the watch was beautiful, stylish, and trendy. But over time, I realized the watch had come to represent more than a fashion statement. When I'm at home on my days off, my standard uniform is sweats, a t-shirt, and tennis shoes. I started to notice that when I left the house to run a simple errand or two, I always put on my expensive watch. So there I would be, in the grocery store, or at the dry cleaners, wearing my casual clothes and my expensive watch. I did it for years, but never asked myself why. One day, after feeling something about wearing it, I was brave enough to ask myself, why do I feel the need to wear my fancy watch whenever I'm dressed down? My honest answer? Because I don't want to be perceived as poor or less than people I may encounter. Now, at first glance, this reason might seem a little self-conscious, but maybe not so bad. It's just a young man taking pride in himself and showing off his hard work, right? Not quite. Getting to the truth meant digging deeper. To find the unhealthy pattern, I had to ask another why. Why is it important to me not to be perceived as inferior to someone I may run into? It was my response to this question that helped me identify that there was a problem with my perception of self, my processing about how others perceive me, and my pride-based reaction, which was crying out, "Look at me, I'm equal to you." The fruit was a false sense of self-worth and value, one based not on my identity as the beloved, but on a material item. By asking two whys, I had uncovered a doozy. It was an unhealthy pattern that nurtured my insecurities. By attaching my self-worth to a watch that I thought would earn me affirmation and acceptance, I was putting myself in bondage. As long as this unhealthy pattern went undetected, I would be a slave to it, constantly trying and failing to use material things to fill a void only wholeness could fill. Needless to say, as soon as I recognized what was happening, I stopped wearing the watch when I left the house in my sweats. But more important, I surrendered my perceptions and processing to wholeness so my life could be healed and changed. That's when I discovered how liberating it was to walk around without feeling like I needed to prove anything to anyone. It was freedom. Then I began to wonder how much money that pattern had cost me over the years. I quickly moved on from that line of thinking because it almost made me nauseous. Best to leave the past in the past and just be grateful that I'm better now. What about you? Where do you need to ask why? What patterns in your life are aiding and abetting your brokenness and keeping you from the freedom of wholeness? Are you willing to take the time to be still enough to feel your feelings, to listen to your heart? If you quiet yourself, look and listen, you will discover the clues that will help you trace your patterns to their source. You have an inner mechanism that determines the fruit of your life, your perceptions, your processing, and your reactions. To become whole, you have to know yourself intimately and always be willing to question your actions. As you develop new ways of perceiving, processing, and reacting, you'll experience major shifts in your life. And when that happens, the things you once thought were impossible might well become possible after all. Take wholeness by the hand and run forward. You are becoming unstoppable. Part 3. The journey continues. Chapter 9. Step by step. It's important to remember that the pursuit of wholeness is a journey, a long one. In fact, it lasts a lifetime. There will be times when you experience such significant breakthroughs that you might think, it can't get any better than this. I've arrived. But the truth is, for every mountaintop you reach, there's a new mountain yet to climb, a mountain that is taller, steeper, and more difficult to navigate. But don't worry. Everything you learn on the last mountain prepares you to conquer the next one. I share this truth about the long-haul nature of becoming whole, not to discourage you, but to inform you, so you aren't surprised when becoming whole takes longer than you think it should. If we could, all of us would probably choose to be the best version of ourselves overnight. But that's not how the process of growth and healing works. It takes time to work through brokenness that runs deep, and then gets deeper as life goes on. There is no instant fix for that. The process of becoming whole also requires all of our life experiences, the good and the bad. All of it is raw material for creating something beautiful out of our brokenness. Earlier in the book, I likened the process of becoming whole to that of a master potter shaping a prize creation. When a potter spins his wheel, he is creating the movement that enables him to alter, define, and refine the shape of the vessel he's creating. We too require a fair amount of movement as wholeness molds us into shape. Life brings a myriad of experiences, some pleasant and others painful. Wholeness uses both, in fact, needs both, to create a masterpiece of us. The three dynamics of becoming whole. The overarching process of becoming whole can be broken down into three primary dynamics: being altered, being defined, and being refined. Each happens on the potter's wheel during the turns of life. Let's look at them one by one. Altered. The moment the potter touches the clay, he begins working it with his hands to make it pliable. Without pliability, the clay will never become what the potter envisions. The same is true for you and me as we pursue wholeness. This process of change is never easy. In fact, we might wish for an entirely different kind of process, like a digital one. Wouldn't it be cool if we could just download wholeness? You could click a button and be instantly upgraded to the new version of yourself, you 2.0. As nice as that would be, I'm pretty sure it's never going to happen. There are no shortcuts to wholeness, and the slow and steady process of change is a fundamental requirement for getting there. Most of us want to see changes in our lives, but are uncomfortable with actually changing. We don't like the discomfort of feeling undone, exposed, or uncertain, so our first response to being altered is often to resist it. But what's required at this point is just the opposite. Instead of resisting the alteration process, we need to submit to it. Just imagine, you're sitting there on the shelf with all the other clay when the potter suddenly selects you and places you on the wheel. You've admired the finished works the potter created, but you've never seen the process that transformed those objects from lumps of clay into masterpieces. You feel a little nervous, but you also feel excited about what you might become, until the spinning begins. Not only is the world now spinning beyond recognition, but the potter is digging his fingers into you, pushing and pulling you this way and that. Everything about you that once felt firm and secure is being undone in unfamiliar and uncomfortable ways. Despite what you've seen of the potter's work, you begin to suspect that far from being transformed into a masterpiece, you are being deformed into something unrecognizable. It occurs to you that you would probably be much better off just sitting on the shelf with all the other lumps of clay than going through these uncomfortable alterations. But then you notice something. You're getting softer. And the pushing and pulling no longer feels so uncomfortable. You begin to relax a little, trusting that maybe the potter knows what he's doing after all. Oh, to be like clay. In the potter's hands, we are destined to become a masterpiece, but we have to be determined to stay there. Why? Because, unlike clay, when the altering process gets difficult, we can jump off the potter's wheel and go back to the shelf. The altering process is a tough part of the journey to wholeness, but it's essential. This is where we become pliable and soft, ready for shaping into something new. If you choose to lean into this process rather than resist it, if you let wholeness do the work that only a master potter can do, I can promise you that your new form will soon begin to take shape. Defined. I'll be honest. What I love most about the altering phase is when it ends, when the pushing and pulling finally stops, and it's time to move on to being defined. The definition phase is when we begin to take on our new shape. The process of being made pliable and soft wasn't easy, but now you begin to feel yourself becoming something new. Your new form feels lighter, more beautiful. Instead of feeling deformed, you actually feel more like who you really are and wonder how you ever could have settled for being a lump of clay. In fact, you're now so excited about what you are becoming that you're even more responsive to the potter's hands. What once felt like change gone wrong now feels like the best thing that ever happened to you. Just as a potter envisions what the clay on his wheel has the potential to become, wholeness knows the beautiful shape you will take when you are healed and whole. At this point in the process, the rotations on the potter's wheel take you through the following cycle. 1. Identifying is recognizing the self-defeating patterns that keep you from progressing in life. 2. Confronting is facing the unhealthy patterns you've identified. You decide that these patterns cannot and will not continue because you will no longer partner with anything that keeps you from moving forward and becoming whole. 3. Extracting is unearthing the self-defeating patterns, pulling them out by the roots so they can no longer grow in your life. 4. Planting introduces new and healthy patterns where the old ones were extracted. It is never wise to leave open spaces where dysfunctional weeds once grew. Doing so runs the risk of more aggressive weeds returning, causing even more problems than the first ones. 5. Healing takes place after the new patterns are planted and established and leads to a new level of wholeness. At the end of this process, you are no longer the person you once were. A real change has happened, and you know it. Things that used to trip you up no longer do. You've moved past the altering phase and have been defined on the potter's wheel. You went from stiff and formless to soft and pliable, from soft and pliable to a whole new shape. And the good news is, it gets even better from here. Refined. Being altered makes you pliable. Being defined gives you shape. And being refined makes you a masterpiece. The master potter always begins with a beautiful vision in mind and will not stop refining his creation until every detail of his vision is achieved. In the same way, wholeness is not finished with us just because we experience a wonderful breakthrough or two. Wholeness is far from finished with us. I had the privilege of counseling a young businessman who was having some challenges in his marriage. By and large, he was a phenomenal husband, a great leader, and had been healed from tremendous brokenness in his life. The problem was that he and his wife couldn't find common ground in their sex life. He wanted to be intimate with her all the time, literally. If they were home together in bed, regardless of their energy level or interest, he couldn't go to sleep without having sex and would urge his wife to accommodate him. Although she wanted to be responsive, there were times when she just could not bear his untimely advances. This created a tension in their marriage they couldn't seem to get past until he reached out to me for help. In our initial conversation, he described how he was raised in a single-parent family with a mom who didn't show affection very well. His mother worked long hours to make ends meet, and there were many times as a young boy when he was left at home alone. Without a father in the house, his mother became his hero. The only problem was that his hero didn't express love in a way that he could recognize or receive. As he grew older, he became promiscuous and ultimately fell into a lifestyle of sexual addiction. Fortunately, he eventually experienced healing and then settled down and got married. He loved his wife, and it really bothered him that they couldn't get on the same page regarding sex. After listening to his history and asking him questions about what sex meant to him, I was pretty sure I had figured out the root of his problem. His desire for sex wasn't about lust. It was about connection. His mother's absence and lack of affection created brokenness in his life at an early age. His promiscuity was an attempt to experience the love and affection he had longed for. Although he had been healed of his addiction on one level and no longer lived the promiscuous lifestyle, he still needed to be made whole on the next level and in a deeper way. He needed to be refined. The issue that was frustrating his marriage had little to do with his marriage. It was an unresolved internal issue that his marriage had unearthed. Once we traced the problem back to the root, extracted it, and planted in his place a new truth about his mother's love, he was able to experience a deeper level of healing. When he emerged from this refining cycle, he was a new man all over again and could experience life and marriage in a healthier, more rewarding way. No matter how far we travel up the mountain of our potential, we must never deceive ourselves into thinking there's nothing left to overcome. It's something like cleaning up an area where a glass has fallen and shattered, which, by the way, is one of my least favorite chores. No matter how carefully I sweep and scan the floor for broken pieces, it seems like I always miss at least one. Just when I think I'm finished, I catch a glimpse of another small piece of glass that somehow managed to travel all the way to the other side of the room. If I weren't committed to looking everywhere and getting every last shard, I or someone I love could get hurt. That's the attitude we must have when pursuing wholeness. A beautiful mess. As challenging as it is to stay on the potter's wheel, you must remain committed. This is critical to reaching your full potential. Believe me, I know all too well the work it takes to remain in progress. I've had many experiences in this area. Allow me to bring you into one that challenged me to the core. My path to wholeness in this instance wasn't pretty, but the healing that emerged when it was all said and done was undeniably worth it. One day, after attending a rigorous kickboxing fitness class, I experienced intense pain in my right shoulder. It wasn't the first time my shoulder had given me trouble, but this time the pain was much worse. Most of the time, when I had shoulder pain during a workout, I didn't think it was anything serious. Once I took a break and rested, I could return to working out another day. In fact, that's how things had been for at least 2 decades. I simply accepted this condition as normal and went on with my life. But this particular day, I couldn't just move on. Even after I stopped working out, the pain continued and even worsened. After talking the situation over with my wife, I made an appointment with my doctor the same day, and he sent me directly to the hospital for x-rays. After the first x-ray had been taken, the technician asked if I had ever had surgery on my shoulder. What the technician clearly saw on the x-ray was something I had blocked from my memory: shrapnel across my right shoulder blade. When I was 16 and living in inner city Los Angeles, I was the victim of a drive-by shooting. While I was driving home from a fast food restaurant, a vehicle pulled up alongside mine, a brief exchange ensued, and within a matter of seconds, I had been shot. The bullet entered near my right shoulder blade, bounced off, and then traveled up until it lodged in my throat. By God's grace, I survived the physical injury, but in the years that followed, I somehow had blocked out the memory of it. My response to the technician's question was quick and defensive. Oh yeah, I got shot there when I was 16 years old. Immediately, I felt an old familiar feeling. It was the same feeling I'd had when I was trying to pretend I wasn't hurt when my father canceled the fishing trip I had planned. Uh-oh, I thought. There's something broken beneath the surface. Then I felt anxious. My entire disposition changed when my previous injury was discovered. I felt ashamed and extremely self-conscious about being shot. What would these medical professionals think of me? What type of person gets shot? Maybe they would think I was some sort of drug dealer or thug. As a black male, I knew I could easily be stereotyped. I remember reaching into my treasure chest of words and trying hard to impress the doctors with my extensive vocabulary and intelligence. Yet even in the midst of it all, I knew there was brokenness within that I needed to address, and soon. This was a brokenness I never knew existed, and I wasn't ready to face it. I was afraid of what I might discover if I took a closer look. Things were going very well in my life. I was close to closing a partnership deal with a major television network. I was being invited to speak all around the country. My family and I had just moved into our beautiful new home, and our church and businesses were all beginning to thrive. I didn't want to jeopardize any of that by having a personal crisis, but I knew I had to make a choice. Address the brokenness or stuff it back down and try to keep moving forward with my life. It definitely would have been easier to just get lost in all the outer success, but in my heart, I knew better. If I chose not to address what was going on inside me, my life might continue to prosper, but Toure would not. To be whole, I had to go through the messy yet beautiful process of confronting my brokenness. As I began to process the experience of being shot, I realized I had blocked the memory not so much because of the physical trauma, but because of how devaluing the incident was. There was a cold and lifeless look in the eyes of the men who shot me. My life meant nothing at all to them. I wasn't even worthy of their anger. In fact, I believe it would have been less traumatic to me if they had been angry, but their cold, emotionless silence conveyed that my life wasn't worth even the energy of anger. Greater than the pain of the bullet that entered my body that night was the pain of the one that entered my soul. Getting shot that way was the most devaluing thing that had ever happened to me. After working through the shooting step by step and thought by thought, I realized how failing to process the experience in the light of the truth caused it to be ill-processed. I blocked the memory because I had processed the experience into a false narrative that said getting shot was shameful and devaluing. But the truth was that getting shot was nothing to be ashamed of, and it certainly had nothing to do with my value or worth. If anything, the incident was more of a statement about how the perpetrators perceived their own worth and value. Through their violence, they projected onto me the shame they felt and the lack of worth they placed on their own lives. The incident was never about my value, it was always about theirs. As wholeness was leading me to these truths, I began to identify with people who had experienced other kinds of trauma, particularly sexual trauma. Many survivors feel shame about being abused and even blame themselves for what happened to them. But being a victim never makes us responsible for our trauma. We didn't do anything wrong. We don't need to be ashamed, and what happened can't ever take away our value. We are never made damaged goods because of what we endure in life. Even if we experience damaging things, when we allow wholeness to rewrite the false narratives we've told ourselves, the most damaging experiences can be healed and redeemed for our good. Becoming whole is a long journey, one that continues for a lifetime. There is always a new mountain to climb. As we ascend from one mountaintop to the next, we will discover new layers of brokenness we have to examine and work through. As it was with me when my shoulder injury was discovered, there will also be a temptation to shrink back when pain rears its ugly head. But shrinking back doesn't make the brokenness go away. It just postpones the battle for another day, allowing our brokenness to gain momentum. To become whole and to maximize your potential, you must embrace the messy but beautiful process of change. If you do the work, each time a stronger and healthier version of you will emerge. Always stay pliable and soft. Trust the process and allow yourself to be shaped into a masterpiece. Wholeness is still at work, and the best and most beautiful you is yet to come. Chapter 10. Ghosts of the Past. You may not be able to fully grasp it, but you have an unrivaled ally in wholeness. Wholeness doesn't start you on the journey only to abandon you when things get ugly. Wholeness came into your life because of the ugly and won't quit working in your life until everything in it is made beautiful. This doesn't mean things will always happen easily. In fact, many times you will have to fight for your own wholeness. However, you can take courage in knowing that wholeness has pre-qualified you to conquer every obstacle you face on your journey. The very presence of an obstacle is proof you can defeat it. Perhaps the most challenging obstacle we all face on the journey to wholeness is this beast called the past. While the voice of wholeness invites you forward into a better and healthier future, the voice of your past beckons you backward into memories that only haunt you. Just to clarify, I do believe there are healthy ways to learn from the past, such as gleaning wisdom by reflecting on mistakes to avoid repeating them. This is a profitable use of the past because it adds value to your present and future. However, there is also an unhealthy engagement with the past that can derail your present and your future. Sooner or later, the ghosts of your past sneak up on you and try to drag you backward. Ghosts of the past might come in a variety of forms. Sometimes you'll experience them as a yearning for the comfort or perceived safety of life as it used to be, even though life as it used to be was not healthy or whole. Other times you'll feel weighted down by painful regrets or deep grief over the loss of relationships. You may also wonder if that something you overcame in the past is suddenly going to reemerge and threaten your present or sabotage your future. To stay on your path to wholeness, you need to be prepared for these sometimes vicious attacks by the ghosts of the past. Ghost number one, yearning for yesterday. I'm thoroughly convinced that one of the most pointless uses of energy is yearning for a time that doesn't exist anymore. I don't want to appear insensitive here, especially when it comes to memories of special moments we all have experienced in life. Those are priceless treasures we can and should hold near and dear in our hearts. What I am speaking to is more of an obsessive nostalgia that causes you to yearn for a time in your life that no longer exists. When this happens, it's a sign that the ghosts of the past are at your door, and you need to send them packing. In order to experience the power of the present moment, you have to be fully present in that moment. And if your power and energy is spent longing for the past, you forfeit the power to create a future that's even better. There is a reason why your past doesn't outlive you. It's because your past isn't equipped to handle who you are becoming. You're here today because you were made for the now. There is something about you that now needs, and there's something about now that you need. To yearn for the past is like walking through life backward, only ever looking at where you've been. If you would just turn around, you would see even greater things on the horizon. In my own life, I discovered an interesting pattern connected to my yearning for the past. I long for yesterday, only when I felt discouraged, anxious, or uncertain about the present. When I felt confident and certain of my purpose, the past held no attraction for me. That's when I realized that my longing for the past was really about fear. This epiphany helped me to realize that my feelings of nostalgia were an illusion, an attempt to escape whatever unpleasant emotions I was feeling in the present. Longing for the past was a sign that I needed to pause and remind myself that everything I truly wanted was in the present and the future. I reminded myself of all the progress I'd made, all the obstacles I'd already overcome, and the numerous confirmations that the God of wholeness was with me and was still guiding me up the mountain. Even if you could go back to yesterday, you wouldn't fit there anymore. The past worked for you only because of who you were then. You're not the same person anymore, though nostalgia may try to convince you otherwise. Have you ever gone back to visit a place where you once lived or a school you once attended? You were all excited to go back, but when you got there, the place seemed so much different than you remembered. In your fond memories, it was bigger, happier, or more beautiful. But now that you're back, it feels smaller and unfamiliar. Although you have happy memories, you can't envision the present version of you ever fitting in there again. I've had many experiences like that. The life of progress we are called to live guarantees we will forever be outgrowing our past. It's okay to look back and smile from time to time.